Welcome to Gracious Words. Gracious Words is taken from the weekly women's Bible study taught by Cheryl Broderson at Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa, California.
We behold your glory, God, in the face of Christ. It shows us who you are.
Joseph's life demonstrated the faithfulness of God. On today's program, we'll see how the Lord went before Joseph and made preparations for his rescue and deliverance. And now here is part one of Cheryl's message titled, The Vantage Point of Deliverance.
I've been amazed this week as I've been studying Genesis, just how appropriate it is. This passage in Genesis speaks to our fears, and it tells us that we have a deliverer who has already gone before us and made preparations for our deliverance. I don't know what you're going through today, but I want you to know you have a deliverer who has already gone before you. So I want to talk to you just beginning about a man named William Ogden. I bet you don't know that name. It's not a household name. It might have been about 100 years ago. In 1841 to 1897, that's when William Ogden lived. And he was a very famous hymn writer. In fact, he wrote over 200 hymns. And I bet you sing some of those hymns and you don't even realize that William Ogden was the one who wrote them. He lived during the Civil War, and he was 20 at the outbreak of the Civil War, and he enlisted in the 30th Indiana Volunteer Infantry fighting on the northern side. He was originally from Ohio. Well, when they realized his musical talents, he was asked to form a men's choir. And this choir was meant to bring inspiration to these men who were fighting against slavery. So most of his hymns have as their backdrop the violence, the upheaval, and the uncertainty of the Civil War, where literally thousands of Americans were dying. One of my dad's favorite hymns was written by William Ogden, and it's, "He is able to deliver thee." Perhaps you remember, if you've attended Calvary or been here, some of the lyrics. It went like this, and I'm going to resist singing it to you, which is really a blessing in disguise. But 'tis the grandest theme through the ages rung. 'Tis the grandest theme for a mortal tongue. 'Tis the grandest theme that the world e'er sung. Our God is able to deliver thee. He is able to deliver thee. He is able to deliver thee. Though by sin oppressed, go to him for rest. Our God is able to deliver thee. 'Tis the grandest theme in the earth or main. 'Tis the grandest theme for a mortal strain. 'Tis the grandest theme, tell the world again. Our God is able to deliver thee. 'Tis the grandest theme, let the tidings roll to the guilty heart, to the sinful soul. Look to God in faith, he will make thee whole. Our God is able to deliver thee. These same lyrics have given me so much hope through every crisis of my life. I have found myself singing these very lyrics on the streets of London, in peril, in hard times, in traffic, in all sorts of circumstances. I have found myself singing these songs. I have found myself singing it about prodigals, about struggles, about financial constraints, about things that look like a certain loss. I have found myself singing it over my children, over my husband, over my loved ones, over the church, over my parents. I have found myself singing it over and over and over again because my God, our God, is able to deliver. Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 1 spoke about an overwhelming circumstance in which he was sure that he was going to lose his life. Remember, this is Paul who had lived through riots and hunger and beatings and imprisonments and shipwrecks. Yet in 2 Corinthians 1, 9 through 10, he says this, "Yes, we had the sentence of death in ourselves, that we should not trust in ourselves, but in God who raises the dead, who delivered us from so great a death and does deliver us, in whom we trust that he still will deliver us." God is working in all the circumstances of our life, even the darkest seasons, to accomplish our deliverance. And friends, let me say this. Jesus has already delivered us from our greatest enemies. He has delivered us from sin. He has delivered us from death. He has delivered us from condemnation. But he is even now living and working to deliver us from the circumstances of this life, from the tremendous to the trivial. From our vantage point, we can only at times see the things that are conspiring against us to take us down. Isn't that true? That's all we see is like the worst. The Bible, though, gives us a heavenly perspective. Through the word, we see that God is in the details, even in the hard things, even in the darkest things, taking even the worst that he might do his best for those who serve him. I remember reading a quote years ago by F.B. Meyer, where he says, "Men go to work in the morning at the sunshine and work until the dark. But God works in the darkness to bring about the light." God works in the darkest of circumstances to bring about the light, to cause the sun to rise. I want to remind you that the Bible was not written in an atmosphere of prosperity or of plenty or of perfect pervasive peace, but in the context of upheaval, oppression, betrayal, violence, famine. It is the story of God's continued faithfulness, God's grace, God's provision, God's discipline and training, God's compassions, even in the atmosphere of a broken world. This is what the Bible tells us. This is what the Bible reveals to us by men who were writing in upheaval, in oppression, in betrayal, in violence, in famine, in imprisonment, in captivity. They were declaring to us the goodness, the greatness of the Lord. His good plans and promises are being woven into all the circumstances of life, not in spite of what is happening, but through what is happening in everything. In our lesson this week from Genesis chapters 41 and 42, we get the divine vantage point. To those in the midst of these circumstances, to Jacob, to the sons of Jacob, there is little hope. However, from our vantage point, we know that Joseph is alive and that the power that is working in Egypt is for the family of Jacob, for the sons of Jacob. Already we see that God has been victorious even in the betrayal of Joseph, and has used that for the highest good. We already see that all the hard places in Joseph's life have prepared him and trained him to be the administrator of the world. We see that the famine, God has already prepared for the famine, and that those who seek out Joseph will not starve, but will have plenty, even during the famine. God is working both the deliverance of God's family from the famine and extinction, but he is also working to deliver them from the sin that is slowly but surely eating them alive and keeping them from all of the blessings God wants to bestow on the family of Jacob. God doesn't want any obstacles in our life that will keep us from his blessings. And he will use hard places. He will use famines to bring to light all the lies that we've been living in, all the sin that we've been suppressing, the evil of our past, to bring to light our fears, our doubts, our loss of faith. This is what he's going to bring out in these hard places, that he might eradicate, that he might forgive, that he might cleanse, that he might remove these obstacles that have barred the blessings that he wants to pour into our lives. In Genesis chapter 42, we realize that Jacob's family is in dire straits. There's a famine in the land, and there is not enough grain to sustain his livestock. Jacob needs grain in order to keep his family alive, in order to keep his livestock alive. Without this vital grain, he will lose his camels, his donkeys, his cattle, his sheep, his goats, and therefore his income. See, this is how Jacob made his wealth. This is how he prospered through livestock. It's not through farming. He was a nomad. But he has prospered through raising this livestock. Now there's a famine. There's no grass. There's no feed for the animals. He needs grain. Jacob hears that there is grain in Egypt. So he commissions 10 of his sons to go to Egypt. He will not let Benjamin go with them. After losing Joseph, he probably kept Benjamin so close to him, always in his sights. His name means son of my right hand, and that seems to be exactly where Jacob always wanted him, right at his right hand, right where he could always see him. When I was a little girl, my mother always kept me in her sights. My mother was adopted, so family was very, very important to her, and she was especially protective of me. She wanted me named Sherry, but my father wanted me named Cheryl, which is the feminine form of Charles. And I'm really thankful to be named by my father after himself. That's just something really, really special in that. But in the meantime, my mother had had a really dear friend who had a daughter named Cheryl. And when I was only about a month old, this other Cheryl, the older Cheryl, she was thrown from a horse, her own horse, and she was killed. She died from being thrown from that horse. Consequently, my mother was terrified to ever have me go horseback riding. My mother was raised around horses. She was a very accomplished horseback rider. Nobody knows those things about my mother, but she was very accomplished at riding horses. But she didn't want me to ever ride a horse because she had this fear that I might die. So I was never allowed all my life until I was 13 years old to go horseback riding. And it was at an Idlewild camp, and all the kids were going horseback riding. So my mother decided she would accompany us. She was so afraid of me dying. And she came. And it was like the worst ride of my life. All the horses were tethered together. And I think they were all ancient. I think that we never even traveled above 3 miles an hour. And they were one right behind each other. And it was just a circular trail. I think the Lord did that for my mother. She just needed that relief. But she sat there and she watched and she actually walked alongside my horse. Here's all these kids and I'm the only one with a mother walking beside my horse. I think that's how Benjamin was in the sight of Jacob. Jacob was so concerned. He had lost Joseph and he was so afraid that he might also lose Benjamin. Now, from our vantage point, we know that Joseph is the prime minister. From our divine perspective, we already recognize God's purposes and the fulfillment of God's promises that will be accomplished through this famine. However, for the brothers, there is no such divine vantage point. Joseph's brothers go to Egypt and come into the presence of the prime minister of Egypt. This is incredibly intimidating. They need grain for survival. So they bow before the prime minister of Egypt. They do not recognize their brother Joseph. Remember, it's been 20 years since they have last seen him. He was 17 when they sold him into slavery. Now he is over 30. Last time they saw him, he was dressed as a Hebrew. Now he's dressed as an Egyptian. Last time they saw him, he spoke Hebrew. Now he speaks to them in an Egyptian language through an interpreter, not even directly. Also, those who were officials in Egypt all wore eyeliner. So Joseph's face looks different. His hairstyle is different. His garments are different. Now, Joseph speaks roughly to his brothers through this interpreter. But even as he is roughly questioning them, he is flashing back on the dreams that God gave him over 20 years earlier. In his mind, he is seeing the sheaves of his brother bowing down to his sheep, Genesis 37:7. He's seen his brother as the stars that are bowing down to him in his second dream, Genesis 37:9. From Joseph's vantage point, he is seeing the promises of God fulfilled. He is seeing that God has kept his word to him, that those dreams were indeed divine. And you see, there are two dreams. The first dream is now being accomplished. The sheaves are bowing down to Joseph. But there's another dream. In the next dream, it will be Jacob and the wife of Jacob, and all 11 stars, Benjamin including, bowing down to Joseph. So do you understand what Joseph's vantage point is? He realizes that God is fulfilling all his word to him. Here is this word that God spoke so many years ago, but there's a greater work, a greater word yet to come. Joseph tests his brothers. He accuses them of being spies, of coming to Egypt to seek out Egypt's vulnerabilities. He asks them pointed questions. How is your father? Is he still alive? How is his health? About their family. Do you have any others? Is there a younger brother? He demands that they bring their younger brother to his court. He says, you will not leave this place unless your younger brother comes here. Verse 15 of chapter 42. He commands that they send one of them back to bring the youngest brother to him. Verse 16. And then he places them all in prison for 3 days. Verse 17. Then he brings them out of the prison and he makes an arrangement with them. Do this and live, for I fear God. Verse 18. This word for God, Elohim, this is a Hebrew word, and it speaks of God as the Supreme One. It is the name of God, the Creator. It is the name that God first revealed himself to Abraham as. Then Joseph gives specific orders to his brothers. He tells them that they are to leave one of the brothers behind in Egypt, and that brother will be placed in prison. They are to carry back grain for the rest of their family to Canaan. They are to bring their youngest brother back when they return in order to verify the word they have spoken. The brothers begin to talk among themselves. And in their conversation that Joseph overhears, we realize that what they did to Joseph is still haunting them. This is what they say to each other. Verse 21, we are truly guilty concerning our brother, for we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us and we would not hear. Therefore, this distress has come upon us. For 20 years, these men have lived with the guilt of what they did to Joseph. For 20 years, they can still see the anguish on Joseph's face. 20 years later, they can still hear Joseph's cries, his pleadings with them. And for 20 years, they have attributed all their distress on what they did to Joseph, on the consequence of their actions. They recognize that they deserve the condemnation that they are experiencing. Reuben adds, did I not speak to you saying, do not sin against the boy? And you would not listen. Therefore, now his blood is required of us. This is how they feel. It's coming down. It's finally catching up with us. Here is what an earthbound perspective does. We deserve this distress. We are paying for and we will pay for the evil we did to Joseph. They are being treated as spies. They have not been believed. Their word has no credibility. They have been placed in prison. They are having to leave a brother in Egypt. What they have hidden for 20 years is coming to light and haunting them. How can they expect God to bless, protect, or deliver them after what they have been hiding and suppressing and the lie that they have been living under? Joseph overhears them discussing their guilt. And for Joseph, this is an incredible vantage point. This is more light to already good circumstances. He realizes now how they feel about what they did. He realizes that they have not been free from the condemnation of what they did to him, that God has been faithful to haunt them. God has been faithfully speaking to their hearts, convicting them this entire time. And he also realizes that Reuben tried to save him. Joseph has the divine vantage point. He is in the promise of God. His dreams are being fulfilled. He is hearing that the brothers did have guilt and continue to hold guilt for what they did. Joseph has never been forgotten.
God doesn't want obstacles in our life that will keep us from his blessings. He'll use situations and circumstances to bring them to light. For Joseph's brothers, God used famine to expose the lies and evil of their past. God allows hardships that he might bring freedom, forgiveness, and cleansing. He wants these obstacles removed so that he might pour into us, so that we can live in the fullness of his promises and blessings. Sometimes God may allow a famine so we can return to Him and partake of His love and goodness. We hope you have been blessed by today's Bible study. For more information about the Gracious Words radio program and the teaching ministry of Cheryl Broderson, please visit our website at graciouswords.com. Coming up next time on the Gracious Words program, we'll look further at Joseph and his brothers as we continue our series, Our Great Creator, in the book of Genesis with Cheryl Broderson. We do hope you make plans to join us. Again, for more information, please visit our website at graciouswords.com. This program is sponsored by Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa, California.